Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, day two of the Brett Kavanaugh nomination, and Democrat leaders are in, full pandering to their base. Pretending that they're going to stop the Kavanaugh nomination, Senate Minority Leader, or the confirmation, Senate Minority Leader Pagliacci, distinguishing himself from Ariana Grande, he does have tears left to cry to stop Kavanaugh. Let's see if we can get audio working here. And we're going to continue to see if we can get the audio working here. Kavanaugh is facing down senators as he rolls around Capitol Hill, meeting with people to exchange pleasantries and the like.
Yeah, he started out nice. I mean, he met with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell yesterday. In case Nancy Pelosi wants to know who's the majority leader, it's Mitch McConnell.
It's true.
And he was friendly.
Name.
Yes, thank you. What's his name? And that went very well, and that was a little photo op for him.
Here's Schumer.
President Trump, with the nomination of Judge Kavanaugh, has fulfilled or is fulfilling two of his campaign promises. First, to undo women's reproductive freedom. Second, to undo ACA. And so I will oppose him with everything I've got.
He's got everything he's got. Every last ounce of salt-stained weeping. He will bring to the table. Kamala Harris, erstwhile 2020 contender, along with Hillary Clinton, made it clear that the Democrats are going to do everything they can to focus the Kavanaugh nomination around the issue of Roe v. Wade.
Listen, if you are a young woman in America, or you care about a young woman in America, pay close attention to this nomination. Pay close attention, because Kavanaugh has made his purpose clear. He told us that when he was on that list of 25. He has told us that in every decision that he has made on the issue of choice. And let's be clear about what this is about. It's about government taking on the decision about a woman and what she does with her body, instead of giving that woman and her family and her God the power to make the decision for herself. This is about replacing the authority of government, putting the government's authority ahead of the authority of a woman to make a decision about her own body and her future.
Isn't it funny how the pro-abort left, this is the one area they're not for big government? You ever notice that? I mean, this is an organization that wants to defer individual sovereignty to the government on almost every score, except when it comes to abortion. I just find the philosophical disconnect interesting. Also interesting on this, the politics of this, Sacha Durbin and others of the hard left and safe seats are advocating that some of their colleagues effectively commit harikari by voting against Kavanaugh. So these red state Democrats that are up for re-election. And remember, one in four Trump voters said the Supreme Court appointments was their deciding issue. That was animating their vote. And of that cohort of voters, Trump won that by 15 points.
Elections have consequences. And for the Democrats that sat on their hands and didn't participate, or the Democrats that went for Bernie Sanders and couldn't possibly vote for Hillary Clinton, this is what happens.
Well, a new Axios poll, a couple of these swing districts, these pickup opportunities for Republicans in the Senate, shows three of those challengers to Democrat incumbents ahead in the polls right now. Joe Manchin is down to Morrissey. John Tester also losing by double digits.
Wow. What about Heidkamp?
I'm sorry. Manchin and Tester are up by double digits. The polls, reverse that. The polls showing Democrat senators, incumbent Democrats that are down. Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, Bill Nelson in Florida, Joe Donnelly next door in Indiana. Those three incumbent Democrats are right now down in the polls. So now you're asking them to take an additional bullet by voting against Kavanaugh. I think that's something that they're not going to do, because they're not going to stop Kavanaugh's confirmation. No. These silly yarns that are being spun by the likes of Keith Ellison that just don't show up. And then if we could get one or two Republican holdouts like Susan Collins or Lisa Murkowski, then there won't be a quorum, so they can't have the vote. I mean, it's just nonsense. And they'll go through these histrionics for a few days, which is why McConnell should get the hearing scheduled and this vote done as soon as possible to minimize this and move on. Although, to the extent that it puts these Democrat incumbents in a trick bag, I guess that's helpful for Republicans. But they're not going to stop the confirmation, and these Democrats aren't going to give up their seats, which effectively they'd be doing, or certainly increasing the likelihood they give up their seats for this quixotic adventure of trying to stop Kavanaugh's confirmation. I just don't see it.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. AM 560, The Answer.
Boy, I'll tell you what, pertains to this Supreme Court pick, you know, Rick Santorum was pretty disappointed Tom Hardiman was not selected again.
Tom Hardiman.
But it doesn't mean that the Democrats won't still attack Tom Hardiman, even though he's not the nominee.
Well, they keep showing they did a piece on
DNC.
The DNC talked about let's stop Kavanaugh, and they put a picture of Hardiman up. Look at this. See it right here?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the guy can't catch a break.
Yeah.
Poor thing.
I'll tell
not
you.
Not only was he the backup the first time, but he wasn't even the backup this time that we know of.
Let's be clear, a vote for Kavanaugh, SCOTUS would be a vote to rip health care from American families, deny women their right to make their own health care choices, and you know, Tom Hardiman is in the wanted poster here that Tom Perez tweeted out.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's, you don't even have to get nominated in order to be treated to the scorn of the left, unhinged as they are.
Judge Kavanaugh should not be allowed anywhere near our nation's highest bench.
Yeah.
The caption underneath this picture.
And the other thing, too, we went through this a little bit yesterday with our two guests on the topic, Georgetown Law Professor Randy Barnett and then the Ed Meese Legal Studies Center Director at the Heritage Foundation, John Malcolm, about some of the more controversial opinions issued by Kavanaugh, particularly the Obamacare case. And I know Judge Napolitano has expressed disappointment in the Kavanaugh pick because of that case, and Mark Levin has excoriated Kavanaugh and the selection of Kavanaugh because of that. And we had our two guests, both conservative legal scholars,
right,
had differing opinions on what exactly Kavanaugh was doing in that Obamacare case, Randy Barnett being much more critical. And I understand the criticism, but I don't understand based on the sum total of the record, you know, the concern that this is David Souter redux. I don't see that at all. So it's one thing to disagree with a particular opinion, the Priest for Life case, the Obamacare case. I get it. There's legitimate criticisms to be lodged there, or arguments to be made, at least, in critique of Kavanaugh. But to suggest this is another stealth justice David Souter who's going to wind up siding with the left more often than with the originalists on the bench, on the high court, like Clarence Thomas and Alito, I don't see that.
Well, then I read an article, too, about some conservatives have lobbied against them. There's a decision last year involving, remember that teenage girl who was arrested for illegally entering the U.S.?
Yeah, that's it.
And she wanted
case.
To be let
right.
go to get an abortion. And Judge Kavanaugh said she had no right to an abortion on demand, but that she could wait until she was released to a sponsor. And some critics said that, she has no right to an abortion because she's not a U.S. citizen.
I've seen that case, and it's a relatively minor issue. He basically was silent on the issue mm-hmm. of whether theoretically she would be entitled to an abortion under different circumstances. But again, what you see in those cases where you're getting conservative criticism from Kavanaugh, arguably, is judicial restraint, not leftist judicial activism. And those are two very different things. So there are criticisms that are where arguments can be made. There are arguments to be made in criticism of some of Kavanaugh's decisions. But again, this kind of I understand we're a little bit gun shy because of so many bad appointments by Republican presidents. David Souter being sort of a watershed moment. George Herbert Walker Bush nomination, but also Kennedy and Sandra Day O'Connor from Reagan. So I get why people are jumpy about it, but I'm just not. But the difference here is you have somebody with an extensive record across a range of issues. And I'm not seeing how he's going to somehow do a 180 and become David Souter. Now, could he be a John Roberts and be a slow walker rather than cement a conservative revolution on the court to in advance of originalism and the black letter of the Constitution? Could he be a slow motion guy instead of a revolutionary? That's possible. It's possible. I'm not convinced that that's the case, but it's possible. And I think I agree with Jack Goldsmith's analysis in Weekly Standard, where he essentially says, you know, to cement that conservative revolution, if you will, to undo all of the leftist activism on the court over the last 50 years, you're probably going to need a sixth. You're probably going to need the next justice to be appointed by a President Trump or Republican president. Okay, that's possible. Vince in Waukegan, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Andy.
Good.
You know, people are concerned about how Kavanaugh voted on the Obamacare thing or how the court handled it, and that wasn't the courts to handle to begin with. You know, they're just there to determine whether or not laws are constitutional, and basically they said, yeah, Congress can pass this law, just like they did for Social Security. So it was never the court's decision to make. It was Congress' decision. They're the ones that need to fix it.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Vince. Although I would disagree with that. I think it is the judge's, the high court's role to, as you said, determine if a law is constitutional. And the Obamacare individual mandate, I would argue, is unconstitutional. So it was the court's purview, the high court's purview, ultimately, to declare that unconstitutional, which is what they should have done and didn't do.
If you're talking about it, I'll be talking about it. Dennis Prager here. Join me this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I want to get to this United Airlines lawsuit, but just to close up our discussion of Supreme Court and the Kavanaugh nomination for now. Bruno in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, you know, the people... So Kavanaugh maybe is going to be a good replacement for Roberts, but really the revolution is going to occur when we replace Ginsburg. While maybe Kavanaugh is not a slam dunk, maybe not the perfect candidate, I think given the calculus of the Senate approval process and who we have in the Senate right now, maybe the best that we can do. And if people want better, they need to get out in November and change who the senators are.
Yeah, there you go.
That's all I have to say.
Thanks for the call, Bruno. I think that's generally right. I mean, I see the criticisms of Kavanaugh, the concerns that he's going to be another Trojan horse justice like David Souter. I just don't see them particularly well grounded. The arguments are made by, like, Ross Douthat in New York Times that the real problem here is the opportunity cost. It's not so much about Kavanaugh. It's about what could have been with Amy Coney Barrett, for example.
I understand that. You knew what you were getting with her.
Yeah.
But when Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I think, retires or leaves, I think he will fill her spot. I think Amy has a chance.
Well, we have no idea. You know, I mean, we have no idea when she's going to go. I mean, that these... You know, sometimes these second chances never come. Just ask Tom Hardiman.
Or third chances.
Well, but I mean, I just with respect to Amy Coney Barrett, I mean, she's been on the Seventh Circuit for 5 minutes, mm-hmm. too. So, yes, I understand she's a committed Christian, and I understand that her life and her family's life is a testament to that, and I think she would be an outstanding Supreme Court justice. I think that. We don't have an extensive record on her at that level like we do with Kavanaugh. So, I mean, we're assuming a lot of facts, not in evidence, with respect to actual legal opinions on the range of issues that we have legal opinions on with respect to Kavanaugh, and even Ray Kethledge as well, who was passed over. So I get the opportunity cost. I know there's a lot of excitement in the base with the prospect of Amy Coney Barrett, mostly because of how she handled DiFi and Durbin when she was attacked for her Catholic faith during her confirmation hearing for the Seventh Circuit. But, you know, that's not the sum total of a qualification or a calculation for a nomination. So, all right, moving on. We talked about this case when it first came to light. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a Colorado woman who's suing United Airlines, for failing to protect her from a passenger who was, a retired pilot?
Yeah, his name is Michael Wendell. I think I pronounced it
Monty.
Correctly. Do you think?
Monty Wendell.
Oh, hey. Monty Wendell? Okay.
Monty Wendell.
Oh, okay.
Name assassinated.
I have Michael. Just look. I have Michael Wendell.
Well, you
but he was full Monty. Is that what you're...
Well, not exactly, but I mean...
Play on words. But apparently he was sitting next to Ann Dowling. They were on a flight from Hong Kong to San Francisco, so it's mm-hmm. a long one. So he tried to settle in, Dan. He took an Ambien, but then he drank 3 or 4 vodka sodas, they said in the complaint. And that's when he got a little handsy.
Well, and also, admittedly, he got a little horny.
Well, yeah, he told the flight attendant, Eva Yu, that he was horny. And that, mm-hmm. okay, because you do things when you're on Ambien that sometimes you don't realize that you're doing.
Yeah.
So this woman woke up 3 times to find him groping her. And after the second time, she told him to stop, and he did, but then they went back to sleep again. She tried to snuggle up on her blanket, and then he woke up again. He began rubbing her vajayjay through her clothes while he was touching himself underneath his blanket. And she said something to the effect of, he said this to her while he was doing it, I think you're horny, and I'm horny too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so she decided to leave business class at that point.
Yeah, she went up to a flight attendant, told her what happened, and the flight attendant told her that there were no available seats, and she should go back to her seat next to Wendell. And that's the problem. I think that's why the lawsuit is being filed, because when you're being assaulted and touched by your fellow passenger, the first thing you want to do is get out of there.
You sound like you speak from personal experience. Well, your groping stories on United Airlines or any major carrier, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Now, in Mr. Weddle's defense, we do have some audio of how their conversation started on the plane.
I don't mean to sound forward. I mean, I know I don't know you, but I don't think we're going to live through this. And I've never been with a man before. I know this really isn't the place.
Oh, no, no, I understand.
Here. Who turned off the mic?
So,
well, have you ever asked to change seats?
Contributory.
Or?
Have I ever asked? No. I've been asked to change seats.
What, so a mom could sit with their son or something? Or
yes, yes.
But you never said, "I need help here. I need to get out. Can I please have a different seat assignment?"
No, I've never sat next to Ted Stryker.
Oh,
have you?
Oh yeah.
Why?
One time. Well, we were at. I was 9 months pregnant, covering the Cubs in 2003 in Miami.
Uh huh.
And I was. There was also a rapper convention that same weekend in Miami, and I
Vanilla
was.
Ice?
No, I don't know what it was, but it was a rapper convention because everybody was coming back to Chicago. And I had a 400-pound man next to me. I was in a middle seat. I was 9 months pregnant, and a 300-pound woman next to me. And literally, they squeezed me in, and I couldn't breathe, and I had to get oxygen. So I think his name's Krupski from Channel 2. He's a photographer. He switched with me so that I could breathe and I could, you know, not go into early labor there on the plane. And that's the only time I asked to switch seats.
Did those passengers feel like you were fat shaming them?
At that point in time, I didn't care.
How could the guy fit in between them if you couldn't?
Well, because I was 9 months pregnant. I was huge.
Yeah, but that's not.
Well, it wasn't comfortable.
That's not.
I turned around and I looked at him, and he's sitting there like this. Thanks, Amy. He was squished.
Yeah.
I mean, that's when you got to order two seats for yourself.
You mean the pregnant woman or the other two?
No, the guy.
Yeah.
The 400-pound man. I mean, really, it was bad. But anyway, but back to this. So
you could have had him David Dowd. You could have gone that and just whistled the, have him yanked off the plane.
This woman and then finally went up to a third flight attendant and said, can I please? This has got to stop. And the flight attendant said, yes, this is not okay, but I'm not shocked. And then she let her sit in another seat.
But, I mean, to be fair to the flight attendant, she did give her an extra bag of peanuts to kind of smooth over the discomfort of a man rubbing her crotch while he masturbated under a blanket.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Perfect case of the need for border security right here.
Build the wall now, please.
Bill de Blasio, the Sandinistan mayor of New York City, violated both Mexican and U.S. immigration laws, according to U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Sent a letter, Customs and Border Protection. De Blasio is suggesting they're wrong, but that should be adjudicated in a court of law, but he should be detained until then. De Blasio went to a holding facility. Went down to the border to do one of those pro forma photo ops that politicians like to do. Went to a holding facility for immigrant children denied entry. Then he went to Mexico and crossed into the U.S. to get a view of the facility. A uniformed Border Patrol agent noticed a group on the Rio Grande River floodplain south of Tornillo, Texas, the port of entry there, taking photos of the holding facility. They were asked how they got there. And if their presence was authorized, they said no, their presence wasn't authorized. And when the agent inquired about how they arrived at that point, they pointed to Mexico, like they had crossed the border illegally.
Mm-hmm. Which they did. Yeah.
That's what Border Customs and Border Patrol is saying. It's good enough for me. I think Bill de Blasio should be deported. And because I want the family to stay together, you can deport the de Blasio family as well.
And I love de Blasio and his team. They disregarded the order and just drove back to Mexico. He thinks he's above the law here. I think they should round him up. Where's ICE?
I think he'd be more comfortable in Mexico in terms of Mexico's politics, too, especially with the elevation of Obrador as the next president. So, you know, socialists should stick together, I suppose. Now, this, of course, is the immigration issue continues to be a political football, and you have more judicial orders for family reunification.
Yeah, 40 of the families with children 5 and under have been reunited. So there was a deadline of yesterday, and it's now been extended, but they are making progress. But President Trump, when he was on his way to NATO, spoke with reporters and just reminded him, hey, you know what? If you do something illegally, your actions have consequences.
Well, I have a solution. Tell people not to come to our country illegally. That's the solution. Don't come to our country illegally. Come like other people do. Come legally. I'm saying this very simply. We have laws. We have borders. Don't come to our country illegally. It's not a good thing. And as far as ICE is concerned, the people that are fighting ICE, it's a disgrace. These people go into harm's way. There is nobody under greater danger than the people from ICE. What they do to MS-13 and everything else. So we ought to support ICE, not do what the Democrats are doing. Democrats want open borders. and they don't mind crime. We want no crime, and we want borders where borders mean something, all right? And remember this, without borders, you do not have a country. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
And right now, we're back to the policy that we've had for the last couple of administrations, this catch-and-release policy, that's formally the case, in part because despite all of the heated rhetoric about family separation and keeping families together, and then President Trump issuing the executive order that he did, capitulating to that political pressure, a district court judge in L.A. refused the Trump administration's request to change the longstanding federal court settlement, the Flores consent decree, so that officials could detain asylum-seeking families together during the adjudication of their status. So a judge has blocked the efforts to detain families together pending outcome.
So now it's again back to catch and release?
Yeah, that's what it is.
Okay.
So that's good immigration policy?
Because they're still coming. I mean, thousands a day. Even though President Trump says that you don't want to be separated from your kids, then don't try to cross over.
He might have a point there, especially if you're going to come here illegally and not one of the designated ports of entry for asylum seekers. In addition to that, I mean, just so we've done nothing. We've accomplished very little other than there are some things that the Trump administration has done. For example, visa sanctions were issued against two more countries. Burma, as well as Laos, for their refusal to take nationals from their respective countries back who have been deported. So the U.S. mission in Laos and in the embassy in Rangoon in Burma no longer grant tourist and business non-immigrant visas to senior officials from the Laotian Ministry of Public Security, for example. Restrictions also apply to the officials' immediate families. Christian Nielsen, DHS Secretary, saying that both countries have denied or unreasonably delayed accepting citizens ordered removed from the U.S. So at least we're putting some teeth into the deportation. You're going to take your citizens back who have been removed from the United States for cause, or, you know, we're going to impose a penalty if you don't. Or if you make this unreasonable or unduly delay it. Good. That's what we should do. If you don't have any legitimate reason to be in this country, if you don't have legal status to be here, then you should be returned to your home country. I don't know why that's so complicated or so.
I have changed my opinion on this.
Yeah.
And I feel bad. As a mom, I do feel horrible when parents are separated from their kids. I wish they could all keep them together, but you've got to think the consequences of your actions. What is going to happen? Because they hear these, you know, tales of, oh, it's going to be great in America, and you'll be cared for. Your kids will have food, and you'll be provided for. Because as you said, if there's ever a country where no one will starve to death, it is the United States of America.
Right.
We will not let our fellow Americans or fellow human beings starve to death. It just won't happen. So, but they have to learn that that's, you know,
that
do it legally.
There's a process, right? Yes. And I mean, and frankly, if we establish the rule of law with respect to immigration policy, we could have more sensible immigration policy that would allow for more immigrants. But people don't see it that way. And so instead, what you have is both sides going to essentially pander. One is the abolish ICE crowd.
Right.
Ocasio-Cortez, the new head of the Democrat Party, leading that effort. Although, and by the way, you don't think that's real? There's legislation that's been introduced by a Democrat congressman from Wisconsin to eradicate U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, dissolve the agency within a year of enactment, establish a bipartisan group to decide which agency would manage necessary ICE functions, and in classic big government form, the measure also requires that total federal employment is not reduced with the abolition of ICE. We're going to abolish this agency, but hey, nobody's going to lose their jobs. We just want to abolish this agency to, you know, again, satisfy the hordes that comprise the Democrat coalition, such as it is. So that's on the one side. And the other side, you got Republicans like Tom Cotton and David Perdue co-sponsored legislation, the RAISE Act, which would artificially cap legal immigration at half of what it is functionally today. It would be 500,000 a year. So because we don't do anything common sense, we can't even accomplish things where there's general agreement. You have, I would argue, demagoguery and bad policy ideas emanating from both sides, and that's not particularly helpful either. But the abolish ICE, it's not just a hashtag. You actually have, of course, politicians introducing legislation to, even though it's not going anywhere, to make good on the rhetoric at, you know, Antifa rallies.
And then every night on the news, mainstream media, you call it, they're trying to show these emotional reunions between, you know, a father and his son or a mom and her daughter. And it's not moving the needle with me at one bit. And I don't know why that is. I keep thinking like, where are they going to go now? Because the kids aren't crying. I mean, the moms are crying, but you know, it just seems very staged to me. It's not genuine.
It's sentimentalism over substance. They're not making an argument. They're attempting to manipulate you through sentimentality. I mean, sentimentality is not the basis to make public policy. But, of course, the D.C. press corps picks and chooses their stories in advance of, their handmaids to the left, in advance of the left's position on whatever the issue is, even if it's a policy that the left was ultimately pursuing when they were in charge. Oh, by the way, let's not forget, former Obama Department of Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson, who has defended effectively the policy. He's criticized family separation, but he's at least conceded that they did it during the Obama administration, during the process of determining status, adjudicating cases, number one. Number two, catch and release was the de facto regime, and it continues to be, and that doesn't work either. And number three, an op-ed in the Washington Post, abolish ICE, this is from Jay Johnson, abolish ICE makes for a good rallying cry on the left, demanding the abolition of Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, also provides President Trump with a useful weaponing for bludgeoning Democrats politically. I write to oppose calls to abolish ICE. Abolishing ICE is not a serious policy proposal. Obama's Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson writing in the Washington Post. So, you know, I don't know. I guess as long as you have Republicans that are cowered by the prospect of being called a racist or heartless or, you know, all of the sentimentalist name calling of the left, and obviously the Democrat Party that's for open borders, that's not serious, that's for abolishing ICE, that's for just feeding their socialist base, you're not going to have sensible immigration policy in this country. You're going to have people who could come to this country to contribute and be productive, ultimately American citizens, unduly delayed. You're not going to have improvements to the way we do immigration. So we're not going to have as many people contributing to our country and improving their lives in the process. So it's great. Everybody's a loser in this, except for, you know, politicos on both sides that gain some short-term political capital. And then this issue just continues on and on and on, as it has, well, for the 30 years since the 86 reform, which wasn't much of a reform at all. It's kind of has kept us on this hamster wheel. I mean, for really the last half century, just not sensible, because you don't have serious people. You just have politicians trying to protect their jobs.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, all right, we didn't resolve the topics we were discussing previously, so they need to be revisited. The issue of these doctors as surrogate parents when they're examining your kids. I'm not done with this. I don't have kids. I don't raise kids, but I pretend to raise them on this show.
You have hypothetical
children.
So
I have very strong opinions on this. And then also we were talking, this all was all, that discussion was precipitated by a discussion about Scarlett Johansson playing a trans man in an upcoming movie that I'm not going to see. And Slate, one of the leftist dinks at Slate, arguing that movies should cast cis men to play trans men and cis women to play trans women. If you're doing some chromosomal scoring at home. David in California, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, you know, I've been listening to your show off and on for a number of years, and there's always this smear. You got to be smearing somebody.
Yeah.
Every morning, it's the morning smear, the morning sneer.
Yeah, exactly. Got it. All right.
Okay, so what's the point?
I don't know. Do you have a point? Or is that the point of the call?
Well, we've got a whole bunch, thousands and thousands and thousands of kids are missing from the border. The Trump administration went to court yesterday, said they could only find half of them, and you're talking about some lame junk, a movie.
Well, we were talking about
immigration.
We were talking about immigration for the first 25 minutes of this hour. But
it's a four-hour show.
Thanks for the call, David. It's a pleasure to hear from you again.
Hi, David.
Contributing. Okay, so, I mean, you know, I'm not talking about it if your fellow travelers on the left at Slate wouldn't be talking about it, right? I'm not talking about it if the social justice warriors of the left weren't trying to redefine gender the way they redefine marriage. And they're in the redefinition game. Is that a smear or is that a description of the reality on the ground in all of the civic institutions, which have a real impact on life in this country? Don't they, David? Do our schools, school policy, is that important? Does that have an impact on the quality of life for American families, whether they're recent arrivals or generational residents, citizens, I should say? Does our culture, as evinced in our art, does that impact the way people see the world, David from California? Or is the only argument you have to emote on the topic of immigration, talked about it in great detail the first 25 minutes, including the opinions of Obama's DHS Secretary Jay Johnson, to show everybody how much you care, how good you are? Is that just another sentimental barbarian on the left coast, huh, David? So I'm glad you've been listening off and on over the last several years. Keep listening. And maybe listen to what you're saying and bumping up against the charges you're leveling against the likes of me, talking about topics that are front and center in our culture right now. That's fact. And part of that is government or government agents interceding between parent and child. And that was the second half of our discussion. Also relevant, I know it's not a border security issue, but we're going to discuss it anyway, if you'll permit us, David, in California. And that's what these doctors are becoming. I mean, I was talking to Mike Scott during the break about this, and I mean, the schools have these, you know, forms that doctors have to fill out when you do the physical before they're admitted to school. And it includes some, you know, box checking about did you discuss public health issues, sexuality, et cetera, et cetera. Well, here's what I would say, and take your calls on this. I don't know how you handle it with your kids and your schools and your doctors, family doctors. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. This is the way the government insinuates itself into the rearing of your children through teachers, administrators, medical professionals. This is how the AMA, and then you have a left-wing trade organization, the AMA, you know, calling guns a public health issue, you know, taking positions on gun control legislation, for example. And then now my kid's doctor is going to ask my kid if there are guns in the house, or he's going to talk to my kid about sexuality, sex, drugs, rock and roll, alcohol. I don't care. Here's what I would sell my family doctor if he was going to stay my family doctor for the fictional kids that I raise on this show. Here's what
they're very well behaved too, by the way.
Thank you very much.
You're doing a great job.
Well, I try.
I mean, really.
It's discipline.
They don't talk back.
My fictional kids crave discipline.
I mean, they do.
So here's the thing. I understand you got to check your little box there that you've been turned into an ambassador of the state, an agent of the state. But in order to check that box, here's what you're going to tell Dan Jr. You're going to say, Dan Jr., you listen to Dan Sr. On these topics, just do what your dad tells you to do. Now check your box and move on. because you're not talking to my kid unless we've had a discussion about it. You're going to reinforce my views. You're not supplanting your views for my views on the right of self-protection, on sexuality, on alcohol and drug use, on anything. You're just not doing it.
Why don't we talk about abstinence? We didn't do that. Instead, it was you're 16 years old, you're in a room with a girl, and then next, you know, if you don't cover that up in 9 months, your whole life's going to change.
Is that what he said to him?
Yeah, he said, don't use it as a balloon. He said the word rubber.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. First of all,
I'm standing there like, what?
First of all, Doc, you're creeping everybody out.
I know.
That's number one. Number two,
all right.
You're encouraging my 16-year-old boy to have
sex? You're not having sex. Well, I had to approach it carefully. I said, people wait until they get married to have sex.
I would have said that, again, prop parenting.
Said, okay, Mom.
This is the way. Yeah, so you get the eye roll. There's no eye rolls with my fictional kids. Don't tolerate eye rolls.
I bet they don't play Fortnite either.
They do not.
Ah,
they're readers.
So lucky.
My fictional kids are readers.
All reading, read all the time.
This is what I would tell my fictional son in that circumstance.
Right.
Have you ever heard of Lorena Bobbitt?
But the whole point of contention with me is once my son left and he said, are you sure about his sexuality? Because he didn't like his response to his conversation. So he questioned that he might like boys. And I went, I didn't get that from this interaction. I think I'm sitting next to him and it's embarrassing because his mom is sitting next to me. You're having conversations about this.
Mm-hmm. Is he like Denny Hastert's former doctor and he's just upset he missed that one?
I should take you with me next year when
you should.
Eli has to go through this.
I'd like to go now. I'd like to go for a checkup.
Have you gotten a tetanus shot lately?
I have. No, I have not. Doesn't look like I'm going to be going to Amundsen next year. Tom in Deer Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, hi, good morning. You know, who amongst us doesn't want the doctor or pediatrician to, you know, take care of our kids' health? But our kids were asked this question, and they were advised in advance. Is there a gun in the house? Well, that's none of your business. But if you do feel the need to know, you can check with my mom or dad. And, you know, this is not about health as much as it is leftist politics.
That's right.
There was a court case down in Florida, and it got to be known as Docs versus Glocks. And it went back and forth. I really didn't have the time to look it up. But, again, it was about the right to privacy and how the left or the AMA thinking, using leftist thinking, trying to get into people's homes, their nightstands, and then put it in a database. Exactly what this is about. It's not about safety.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Tom. Holly from Hudson tweeting, at my pediatrician office, my teens are given a clipboard with questions they are to answer without any parent input, please. No dice. We go through the answers together because I'm mom. Yeah. Dennis in Crystal Lake.
Hey, Dan. Hello, Amy.
Hi.
Just to let you know, I raised my three kids myself.
Just like I'm doing.
The warden took off when they were very young.
Maybe she took off because you referred to her as the warden.
Be nice.
So, well, believe me, Dan, if I ever introduce her to you, you'd have a lot more bad things to say than I do.
Okay. All right.
But anyways, I tell my kids if they're going to be heterosexual, transgender, whatever, I don't need no doc to tell them. Play with Barbie without a penis or whatever the heck that is.
I hope. All right. Thanks for the call, Dennis.
Stop staring at Barbie's undercarriage. Oh,
they're not.
They're not
anatomically correct, are they?
No.
We haven't
it's
gone
all
to that.
Just smooth moves.
Yeah. Okay. Just checking. Berlin on the south side.
Yeah, I want to tell Dan from Libertyville, he's an idiot.
Dan from California.
Oh, California. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Well, whichever one. But, yeah, you know, it's people like him that turns a blind eye and lets our country go down the tubes and our culture go down the tubes. And that's the reason why we're the situation we're in. And when you want to talk about doctors, when I did have a significant other and I was living with a significant other, I told her I didn't want my kid on birth control, because I feel like it gives them a free pass to be irresponsible. Yeah. And And we went to the doctor to get her checkup. And I told the doctor, I don't want her on birth control. I don't want her taking that shot from Planned Parenthood, none of it. I want her to be natural. The doctor put me out of the room and told my significant other, men have no judgment, no comment,
right.
and no decision making when it comes to women's health. At that point, I knew my word meant nothing in the house, and that was one of the reasons why I got rid of her and took custody of my kids.
There you go. All right. Thanks for the call,
Verlin. A lot of single dads on the line this morning. I like it.
And in the studio.
And you too, with your hypothetical little love bugs.
They're so cute at this age that I've raised them.
Yeah. Really well-dressed, too.
Yeah, they take after their dad.
Impeccable clothing.
Terry in Lake Villa.
Yeah, just a small correction on what Dave said. He said that there were thousands of children separated from their parents that were missing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not children that are missing. It's the parents that the ICE can't find. So just a small correction.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for the culture. I mean,
some of those kids were brought over by their aunts and uncles and friends and
mules.
So they were able, right. Yeah, and there's 105 lords that are 5 years and younger. They have reunited 40.
Yeah, but they
have to take DNA samples on some of them.
But you have to understand, Dave in California is a good example. He's not interested in what the facts on the ground are. He's not interested in the policy.
Just throws out.
He's interested in saying, "I'm a good person. Look how much I care. I'm rhetorical hand wringing over this because I care so much about kids and families being together."
You know what I care about? I care about your children, Dan Jr. I care about them.
Thank you.
What's your daughter's name? Louise.
I have two boys.
Oh.
Two fictional boys.
Oh, okay. It's easier that way.
Well, we're not ready for a girl yet. Think about, for people want to know how I raised my hypothetical children, think like Courtship of Eddie's Father.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's very similar.
I love that show.
Mike on the north side.
Hey, good morning. I had awkward questions with my doctor on my last physical. I mean, the fact that I was half naked wearing a smock in front of another man wasn't awkward enough.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He started asking me if I had any guns or weapons in the house. And I says, "Doctor, just about anything could be used as a weapon if you use it right." And then he asked if I had ever had suicidal or homicidal tendencies.
Uh-huh.
I says, "Well, it can't be suicidal because I'm here and homicidal." I told him, "As long as I still have Jesus and Jameson, everyone else will be okay. Don't worry about it."
Mike, was this this doctor that you went to visit was? Oh, Mike left. I wanted to see exactly what kind of doctor it was and why his psychiatrist is making him wear a smock and be half naked in front of him. Jesus and Jameson.
Can't go wrong.
It's pretty good. I mean, that is the founder of the LGBT party.
We got, what is it?
Love, guns,
bacon and Trump.
Yeah, Jesus and Jameson all the way.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, excuse me, Dan and Amy, and signature hysterics from the left over Brett Kavanaugh have begun in earnest, and the appeasing of the base is being done by Senate leaders, starting with Minority Leader Pagliacci, who is going to give everything he's got.
President Trump, with the nomination of Judge Kavanaugh, has fulfilled or is fulfilling two of his campaign promises. First, to undo women's reproductive freedom. Second, to undo ACA. And so I will oppose him with everything I've got.
Mm.
With the heat of 1,000 suns.
Yeah, something like
I'm gonna
that.
I'm going to do it.
And Kamala Harris, flying in formation.
Listen, if you are a young woman in America or you care about a young woman in America, pay close attention to this nomination. Pay close attention. Because Kavanaugh has made his purpose clear. He told us that when he was on that list of 25. He has told us that in every decision that he has made on the issue of choice.
Yes, he's made it clear that he believes in the separation of powers and the black letter of the Constitution, and that, of course, is an affront to big government Democrats. For more on this topic and more on what kind of jurist are we going to get with Brett Kavanaugh, what's the impact on the court? Because this is a guy who is going to get confirmed. And he's going to get confirmed relatively easily, if narrowly, because of just the partisan and political environment that we're in D.C. But for more on what kind of a judge and kind of impact Kavanaugh is likely to have, we're pleased to be joined by Gary Schmidt, who's a resident scholar for the American Enterprise Institute, the Strategic Studies and Director of Program on American Citizenship. Gary, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
I'm glad to be on, and I'm also glad not to be in Chicago traffic.
Yes, exactly. Although it's the good news is we're depopulating here, so traffic is getting a little bit better. So with respect to Kavanaugh, you know, you've had Mark Levin and Judge Napolitano really take him to task over his opinion in the Seven Sky case, the Obamacare case, and conservatives are a little gun shy. You know, we've been David Soutered before. We don't want to be David Soutered again. I think a more well-founded concern is that he would be more of an incrementalist like Roberts. But I think that's even a little unfair to Kavanaugh, depending when you look at his record. I think he's much more committed to originalism than Judge Roberts ever was. But your assessment of Kavanaugh as a jurist and the impact he'll have on the court.
Yeah, I mean, to start with, unlike Souter, I mean, we do have, you know, 12 years of right. Kavanaugh's record on the appeals court and the appellate court in D.C., and I think there's something like 300 opinions. So, you know, Kavanaugh's, you know, views about how to think about being a judge are out there for everybody to read. And I think the folks from the conservative side that are picking at some of these cases, there's two things. One, I think it shows that Kavanaugh actually isn't simply a by-the-book, you know, ideologue. But the second thing, I think, is sometimes they fail to recognize is that, you know, on the appeals court, your opinions really, you're supposed to be tied to precedents. And so I think Kavanaugh, in some of these cases, is basically trying to make the best of a situation where the precedents are what they are and deal with them that way. So, but in general, as one would want, he's not somebody who's in favor of the so-called living constitution. He's made that very clear in his writings and speeches and in the court opinion. So he's by far the most established and by far the most clear-headed of the candidates that President Trump could have picked.
Are we surprised, though, that he picked him considering how President Trump feels about the Bushes and also that he is, as many describe, a D.C. insider, born and raised there, his mom's a prosecutor there? Do you think that's going to affect any decision-making?
I think that's passed. I think there's another side to Donald Trump, which is that he likes that, you know, credential stuff, and Brett Kavanaugh was educated at Yale, got his law degree at Yale, has taught at Harvard and at Yale and Georgetown. So there's two sides to that. There's the Trump, you know, one reason why Brett Kavanaugh wasn't on the original list was because it was thought he's part of the D.C., you know, appellate court, so therefore it's got to be not a, you know, good thing. But then I think Trump was convinced to put him on the list over the last couple of years because inside the White House, the lawyers that advised Trump were all know Kavanaugh and know what a fine record he has. So I think they've overcome that.
Given the left's rhetoric on Kavanaugh, and not surprising, but nonetheless unbridled and unhinged. Do you think that based on what they believe about Kavanaugh, that he's going to lead to the deaths of people, that Justice Kagan should be impeached for hiring him at Harvard?
I mean, what's funny about this is that, again, Kavanaugh is well known among, you know, all kinds of lawyers, left and right, and because of his years here in town, but also other things he's done. And to a T, they all find him to be just, A, having a very sound judicial temperament. That is, he doesn't sort of yell and scream at everybody. And also, he's just a very fine guy, and he's seen as such, down to earth. And so if you were to ask, you know, 80-90% of the liberal lawyers or judges that he's come in contact with, they would all sort of say he's a fine guy. But, of course, none of that's going to matter when it comes to how the Senate Democrats are going to act about it. They're going to act like the world's ending if he gets onto the court. And the truth is, it is a big change. I mean, as much as Kavanaugh was a clerk for Kennedy, he's not Kennedy-like in how he'll approach a lot of key issues. And so there will be, I think, changes made to all kinds of decisions that would have probably shifted center-left in a lot of cases, and they'll be moving to the center-right if Kavanaugh's on the court.
Well, speaking to that, how Kavanaugh was a clerk for Justice Kennedy, I don't know if you read the reports yesterday from NBC, but they were suggesting that Justice Kennedy retired because he would be more comfortable if he was replaced by a former clerk, and that he had a deal made with President Trump.
Totally unfounded reporting that they later essentially walked
back. Did they walk it back?
Yeah, started to.
Yeah, and also I got to say, you know, anybody who's dealt with President Trump on any kind of issues, the idea that, you know, one day you've got an agreement with him and that's possibly going to stay the next day is a little bit, you know, foolish. So, no, I mean, I'm sure Justice Kennedy, again, Brett Kavanaugh, again, emphasizes too much, is just a really fine guy. And so I'm sure Kennedy thinks that, you know, it would be perfectly fine for Kavanaugh to replace him, even if they don't totally agree about, you know, key issues that the court may face.
Well, one of the key issues is going to be abortion. And, of course, yep. Kennedy was, from my point of view, on the wrong side in Casey. And this is Ross Douthat has an interesting piece in New York Times on this topic about the current Republican coalition. And without its, he writes, without its Federalist Society and its all intellectually impressive work, wouldn't have millions of voters in its corner. At the heart of the promise is a pledge that what happened in Casey, when these Republican appointed jurists limited Roe's ambit, but basically upheld his vision, will never happen again. And he is pretty optimistic that the Roberts Kavanaugh court will vindicate the trust pro-lifers are placing in it. Others, including Andy McCarthy at National Review, are not so convinced. But he suggests that one way or the other, the landscape on abortion is going to change, because either that trust is going to be vindicated by Kavanaugh and this court, or it's not. And that's going to have huge electoral consequences. Do you agree with that?
Well, yeah, I think you know, Kavanaugh, given what he's written and what he's in various opinions, but also what he's done in lectures, he obviously thinks Roe v. Wade, whatever the final judgment was, that the opinion itself, the constitutional character of the opinion is dubious. Having said that, I also think Kavanaugh is very aware that the court has to be careful, that he just can't go in willy-nilly just sort of, you know, taking precedents that have been in existence for so many years now and just toss them out. That's, you know, that's the kind of thing the Warren Court did, and it really cost the court its legitimacy for years until William Rehnquist could sort of settle things back down. So there's a tension between, I think, Kavanaugh thinking that Roe v. Wade's underlying rationale constitutionally is pretty dubious, but on the other hand, he's very aware of how the court has to behave in making adjustments. I think what you'll see, in fact, is the court using the issue of federalism to allow states to modify abortion rights in a way that they think is reasonable. The court will still have to make decisions about whether that's reasonable or not, but I think there'll be more leeway for the states under this court, if Kavanaugh is on the court, to have more say over abortion rights.
On the issue of the Federal Society, since you you work for a think tank and you're part of kind of the tapestry of think tanks, and
I'm deeply in the swamp.
but you know, David Brooks had a pretty good piece, and it's not something I say with frequency about Brooks, but about Kavanaugh, but about the Federal Society in particular, which has been raised in profile because of the list of 25 and Leonard Leo's involvement, and they're now being targeted by the left, which tells you how effective they are. But one of the things he says, sort of a lesson for conservative grassroots and any organization generally, but I'm applying it to conservative grassroots, he says of the Federal Society, if you emphasize professional excellence first, if you gain a foothold in society's mainstream institutions, if you build a cohesive band of brothers and sisters, you can transform the landscape of your field. He's essentially arguing about the intellectual heft that was brought to developing conservative legal talent for the express purpose of judgeships and ultimately Supreme Court justices. And 35 years after its founding, the Federal Society is having this impact because they took this approach organizationally.
Yeah, I mean, one of my mentors, I have a PhD from University of Chicago, but one of my mentors when I was getting that PhD was Anton Scalia. Who was teaching the law school at the time, and what was always struck me is the degree to which the Federal Society folks were very conscious of not so much sort of making themselves a movement at the beginning, but very conscious about sort of having lively discussions and debates about the substance of the law and the Constitution. It still goes on today. If you go to a Federal Society meeting, let's say deregulation, you'll have three or four guys. They're conservative, but they won't necessarily disagree with each other or agree with each other. And so you have this very interesting intellectual exchange. So it's this combination of, having the Federal Society be an association where people get to know each other and be able to promote each other. But at the same time, it only really works because the intellectual heft of the organization is what it is. And it's not one that just is simply kind of a political action committee. It's much more of a intellectual effort on their part to make sure that conservatives, have deep thoughts about what they're doing in this particular profession. So it's a remarkable organization, that's for sure.
He is Gary Schmidt, Director of Program on American Citizenship and Resident Scholar for the American Enterprise Institute. Gary, thanks for joining us. Appreciate your insights.
Thanks for having me on.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
More of Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy comes your way now. And make sure to join me, Larry Elder, tonight at 7, only on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, he's at it again. Beijing is has not heard the last from President Trump when it comes to tariffs. The Trump administration escalating a burgeoning trade war with China yesterday by publishing a list of $200 billion worth of Chinese goods that it proposes to hit with an additional 10% tariff. Lighthizer, Bob Lighthizer, the U.S. trade rep, saying, rather than address our legitimate concerns, China has begun to retaliate against U.S. products. And so now we're going to retaliate against our citizens the way that the Chinese are retaliating against theirs, which is essentially what the net of it is. I don't understand why President Trump and Peter Navarro and Bob Lighthizer don't understand that we don't have a trades deficit. We have a good surplus. That's what that's what a trade deficit is. It's a good surplus. It's not a bad thing. For more on this topic and an answer to answer the question, where the hell is Larry Kudlow? We're pleased to be joined by Steve Moore, chief economist for CNN. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Steve.
Hi.
I know we keep having to revisit and revisit with each tariff increase, but Are you still confident we're going to get to the Kudlow zone at some point in the not-too-distant future?
Well, look, I mean, this is starting to look a little bit like a trade war, isn't it? I mean, a trade war is when you keep escalating rather than de-escalating. And, you know, we're now at the stage where, you know, China responded to Trump's terrorists with higher tariffs, and now Trump is responding to that with higher tariffs. And so we're right now moving in the wrong direction when it comes to getting this resolved. I still think it will get resolved. I think that Trump believes, and I happen to agree with them, that in the end of the day, China has more to lose here than we do. I mean, China really, you know, their economy is not doing very well right now. Their stock market's been doing really poorly. Our economy is pretty muscular right now. If you look at all the indicators on jobs and growth and investment, really, really good numbers. So, you know, I think this is a game that Trump is going to win. And I think he's playing his quote, Trump card by imposing these tariffs. How long this is going to take, though, it's hard to know. And look, it's rattled the financial markets. In the end of the day, I think Trump does believe that China is adversarial to the United States. But look, I agree with you. Of course, trade in. Of course, you know, we all learned this in, you know, high school economics, that free trade is good for both countries when countries, both voluntarily exchange goods and services with each other. But it is also true, and you know, Dan and Amy, I want your guys' reaction. I'm going to play Donald Trump, and you play Larry Kudlow. I mean, look, Trump says they're not playing by the rules. It's not free trade if a country is not opening up their markets to us. It's not free trade if they're stealing our technologies. How can we live with the status quo? Now, how do you answer that?
Well, stealing technologies is...
to answer it.
Stealing technologies is a crime. I mean, can't we arrest the people that are doing it?
Well, arrest them in absentia.
Exactly.
How are we going to extradite them to this country?
But I don't know. I mean, I just... $200 billion now.
No, I mean, Amy, that's actually a good point. How do you get these countries... And by the way, it's not just China, although China is clearly the bad actor. Now, you know, we produce more and more... of what we produce as a nation is a lot of intellectual property. It's patents. It's copyrights. It's computer software, things like that, that are pretty easy to pirate and steal. And it's become an increasing problem for a country like ours, that so many of these countries believe they can just have at it. I mean, a new drug is a good example. It takes $2 billion to develop a new drug, and then these other countries just take the technology, the know-how that went into that, and then they just, steal it, and they don't pay us for it.
So that's
just one little example of, and by the way, that makes drugs more expensive in the United States, because if the other countries aren't going to help pay for the research and development, then American consumers do. And all of this goes on Trump's point is it's gone on year after year after year, and nobody ever stood up to China.
Yeah, but that's not really Trump's main argument. His main argument is
misunderstanding
of trade deficits.
Yeah. That's a point that I think you're exactly right on, which is that he is obsessed with the trade deficit. Now, look, we do have a pretty big deficit with them. I mean, they sell us $500 billion a year of products. They buy 150 from us. Now, you're right. We also import a lot of capital from China. And so that's a good thing for the United States. That means the factories are being built in the United States. And incidentally, you know, one of Trump's arguments is, see, we're losing factories and manufacturing jobs because of the trade deficit. Has anybody looked at our manufacturing sector right now and our jobs market? I mean, what are we going to do with all these new jobs that we create? I mean, we already have 5 million more job openings than we do have people to fill them. So I guess the point I'd make to Trump is, look, everything is going so well right now. I mean, we've got an economy that's just soaring right now. We are the envy of the world. Is this the right time to be, picking a trade fight, not just with China, but with Germany, with Canada, with Mexico? You know, there's where I kind of find fault with the president.
So is the end game to have no tariffs whatsoever on both sides, just to have free trade?
Well, it's funny because I was over at the White House. I spoke to Larry Kudlow, had me speak to the kind of economic council there. And I suggested, I said, look, Trump put down the table, I shouldn't say Larry Kudlow did, but Trump said it, why not zero tariffs? And it was very interesting that none of the Europeans or Canada were much interested in that idea. So that tells you a little bit about how fraudulent they are when they accuse us of protectionism. But, look, I do think ultimately what Trump wants is he wants these other nations to just open up their markets to American companies. And, what's wrong with that?
Well, it's that's a laudable end. It's the means to get there.
That's
question.
True.
I want to get.
You know, I wish, guys, that Milton Friedman were still alive today. You know, I really do. I had the privilege of knowing, Milton Friedman when he was in his 80s and early 90s until he died. And he was of sound mind until he died. And I would have loved to have just heard, I would have loved to hear how he would have reacted to this. I know what he would say.
Yeah.
He would sound more like you, Dan. He'd say, you don't fight, a tariff with a tariff.
Yeah, nobody does a Milton Friedman impersonation like I do.
Exactly.
And I also do a great Rose Friedman.
I think Amy's is better than yours.
Yeah. No, I'm better at Rose, but yeah. No, Dan performs at Zany's.
Yeah, yeah.
Milton Friedman. The crowd loves it, especially in Chicago.
They love impersonations of economists at the comedy clubs. Let me get your take on another topic, Steve, because part of his robust record is in an area I know that's important to you, which is the unaccountable fourth branch of government, the administrative state, the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. Your reaction to that, speaking of it from some of his decisions in the economic realm.
Yeah. So first of all, I'm on a sort of personal crusade about this. Okay. So write this guy. Do not call it the administrative state. That is the stupidest term. Whoever invented that term should just be fired. I mean, that's the problem with us. We come up with it. What does administrative state mean? Call it the regulatory stranglehold or something like that. But calling it the administrative state is one of the dumbest terms I've ever heard. Okay, so that's point number one.
Got that?
Yeah. All right, got it.
Point number two, look, I don't know Kavanaugh. I've never met him. I know there's some grumblings within Trump land that he's a Bush guy and so on. And look, I think he's going to be fine. He's going to be another conservative voice on the court, a vote on the court. If he is going to be confirmed, unless he totally screws up in his nomination hearing, and I don't anticipate that. He's a very smart guy. The implications of this, folks, if you're a conservative, and especially for the kind of never-Trumpers who are still left in the conservative movement, you put Kavanaugh on this court, you're going to probably have a conservative court now for 20 years. That's a big deal. And if he gets one more court appointment, you're talking about maybe 30 years of conservative reign on the court. That is the reason you're seeing a complete meltdown, a derangement by the left over this court. Now, I don't believe that Roe versus Wade is in any danger of being overturned. I do think some of the I don't think that this court would overturn Roe versus Wade, but I do think in terms of economic freedom, and we saw one of the biggest. I would refer your listeners, did you see my piece in the Wall Street Journal today, guys? I have a piece with Art Laffer about how the court did Illinois and California a big favor last week when they did the decision about taking away some of the power of the public sector unions, because Illinois, we've talked about this week after week on this show, but Illinois, California, New Jersey are the three states that are in the worst financial shape right now, and they are all dominated in Trenton and Sacramento and in Springfield by teachers' unions. I mean, am I wrong about this?
No.
Isn't it true the teachers' unions run the state of Illinois?
Along with SEIU and AFSCME, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so this means we estimate that because of that Janus decision that basically says, that, by the way, it's not anti-union, it simply says people cannot be forced to join the union against their will, which is a basic American right. Because of this, we think that the Illinois teachers unions and the California teachers unions are going to collect about 40% less dues. That means maybe, let's keep our fingers crossed, maybe these guys in Springfield who we elect might stand up to the unions and do something about the pension deficits, which I saw this Chicago Fed study. I think I mentioned this a few weeks ago, that shows that to close your pension deficit, just to give you a sense of how big it is in Illinois, you would have to raise property taxes by about $2,500 per family. For every family that has a house in Illinois, you'd have to raise their property taxes $2,500 a year for 30 years.
That's only for
to close the deficit.
That's only for the state pension funds. That doesn't account for like police and fire pensions at the local level.
Oh, it doesn't?
No.
I didn't even know that.
Uh-uh.
So now you're probably talking about a $3,000 or $4,000 increase in property. And by the way, that doesn't mean better schools, better roads, better police, more police, more fire, better parks or anything like that. Every penny of that is going to go to pensions. By the way, I would bet half of those people don't even live in Illinois anymore.
Yeah, like you. They fled. because they're smart.
You know, they've gone to Palm Beach and they're collecting a big fat pension for people who live in Chicago and Moline and Aurora and, you know, Elgin. And it's the most absurd thing that you guys. So answer my question. Why do you guys keep allowing that to happen?
Hey, listen there, Steve. You know, you fled to the Tony Beltway area. Meanwhile, me and my brethren here, we're the ones who put together the Janus case and the Pam Harris case versus Quinn before that. So we can't say
I got to say this. You guys were huge. You helped change the country because of that. So thank you. I mean, no, seriously, this was a monumentally important Supreme Court decision, and I'm tipping my hat to you guys because I know you talked about it over and over again. And this court case, originated in Illinois, wasn't it?
Yeah, Mark Janus is a state of Illinois employee. Yeah. That's right.
So fantastic. I mean, you guys, give yourselves a pay raise.
Illinois Policy Institute, Liberty Justice Center. Yep.
It's important.
I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass. This is a huge decision. It's because of the Dan and Amy show that it happened. And by the way,
By the way, also, you know, we can't do anything about Illinois.
John Tillman at the Illinois Policy Institute. This shows what happens when the conservative movement flexes its muscle. Now, my question for you guys is, can Rauner save himself because of this?
No. He's gone. Okay. He's gone. Illinois is gone, but at least we've done something to try and save this representative republic outside of Illinois. So that's something.
Well, it's not done yet. You know, you still have, I mean, Chicago, as I said, one of the great cities in the world. And, you know, we'll see. I think this might turn the tide in Springfield. You might actually get some rational policy now because public sector employees. By the way, the public sector employees in Illinois get pay and benefits and salaries that, by our estimates, are about 40% what an equally qualified private sector worker gets.
Yeah, and they're a bargain at twice the price. He is Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, chief economist for CNN. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
All right, guys. Have a great week. Take care.
Take care.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and we've spent the last couple of weeks talking about a lot of seminal Supreme Court cases, United States Supreme Court cases. We're just talking about the impact of the Janus decision with Steve Moore in the last hour. Well, a decision that came down last week at the state level in Wisconsin Supreme Court ruling, is important for academic freedom. Now, technically, it was a contract case, and it's a case that we profiled on this show previously involving Marquette professor John McAdams. We had Professor McAdams on the show before. And the coverage of this case is really interesting. It tells you everything about the perspective of the left and the right when it comes to the judiciary, which is what we're discussing with the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh. But here it applies at the local level as well. Ultimately, the Wisconsin Supreme Court finding that Marquette University violated its own handbook, its own policies and procedures with respect to academic freedom for professors by sanctioning Professor McAdams for his questioning of a graduate student instructor over her treatment of a student in class when it came to discussions of controversial topics. The Supreme Court ruling that Professor McAdams was in the right, that Marquette University, even though it's a private institution, and conservatives would be loath to tell private institutions the terms by which they must employ or not employ people. We've talked about free speech cases when it comes to private institutions, like in the case of James Damore at Google. But this was a contract issue, ultimately. It's a contract issue that has important academic freedom implications. And for more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by that Marquette University professor, John McAdams. Professor McAdams, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. Good morning. Good to be here.
So you filed suit against your employer, Marquette University, for violating the terms of employment. And just give us the backstory again of what gave rise to this litigation.
A student came to me to tell me about an after-class discussion with a philosophy instructor. In class, she had briefly mentioned gay marriage and said, I think that's right, that she thought there should be gay marriage. He approached her after class and said he'd like to talk about that in class, and he made it clear he was opposed to gay marriage. Mm-hmm. Now, she could have said, I didn't think that would be a good use of class time. She had every right to say that, no harm, no foul, but she didn't. She said, if you said that, don't you think it would come across as homophobic? And you're not allowed to make racist, sexist, and homophobic comments in class. And if there are any gays in the class, don't you think they would be offended if you said that? So he came to me. He had a recording of the exchange, which is legal in Wisconsin, and I blogged about it. Well, nothing happened for a little while, and then it went national. Partly because people picked up on my blog post, but partly because the instructor, Cheryl Abate, went to a philosophy blog to complain that she had been the target of a political attack. So eventually it was all over the place, and she started getting some unkind emails. No threats. Marquette keeps saying she got threats. She admitted on her blog she didn't get any threats, but some of them were unkind. So Marquette, you know, blamed me for that and said I was reckless in naming her in my blog post, and has been trying to fire me for about 3.5 years, up until last Friday when they were slapped down by the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
So you stayed in your position as a professor the entire time, correct?
Well, suspended. I was suspended
right.
The
but
entire
time. What does
that
mean? So you couldn't
that
teach any
to
class?
Say, I wasn't allowed to go in my office. I wasn't teaching classes. Okay. After March 2016, I wasn't being paid.
Yeah, so back pay is one of the issues. And the Supreme Court, I assume, held that you were owed back pay?
Yes.
Right. So
well, that's got to be a relief.
Let me tell you what Margaret Carlson wrote, if you haven't seen it in the Daily Beast, too, just in terms of how the left characterizes this, the left that are quick to support totalitarianism on campus, squelch diversity when it comes to opinions. Margaret Carlson suggests that you opened her up, this instructor Abate, opened her up to the Wild West of the Internet by linking to her personal information so others could hate on her, and at your blog that you effectively doxed her, providing personal identifying information to make it easier for others to harass her.
Yeah, well, that's entire nonsense. I linked to an essay of hers about how all men are responsible for the prevalence of rape. why? Basically to show what kind of feminist she is.
Mm-hmm.
There was no information at all on the page I linked to. If someone had dug around her blog, they could have found her email address. Now, is an email address personal information? Not really. If you put it on the World Wide Web, it would have been much easier for someone to just Google her name, and she would have turned up among Marquette philosophy graduate students. But anybody who just casually looks at the media knows that when someone's guilty of misconduct, they're always named. Like there was this case recently of this pool guard who demanded an ID from a black woman, apparently thinking, well, in this white suburb, she must not belong here. So he demanded an ID when he hadn't demanded that of white pool goers. And not only, and he's always identified in all the stories.
Right. Now, so with respect to your colleagues at Marquette, a putative Jesuit university, how are they reacting to you? How were they reacting to you for the last couple of years, and how are they reacting to this decision?
Well, there's sort of a core of leftist, left-wing faculty that have been very opposed to me. They've signed a statement saying I should be punished, et cetera. This is like a few dozen faculty out of several hundred, although it's typical on university campuses that it's the leftist, and indeed the intolerant leftist, who are the people who are loudest, who raise a fuss, and whom administrators feel it prudent to pander to. Only a couple of faculty have overtly stood up for me by writing articles defending me. Several more have emailed me, but don't want their names used. There are probably a lot more conservative professors who keep their heads down, and probably most professors at Marquette don't care much one way or another because they're not that political. I don't think the engineering school is that political.
But what about Cheryl Abbott? Is she still there? Have you run into her
gone.
At all?
She gone.
Cheryl Abbate left for the graduate program at the University of Colorado. Marquette has claimed that my blog post was the reason for her leaving, but internal documents show that she had tried to get into the University of Colorado graduate program the year before, and they wouldn't take her. But after all of this broke, they reached out from Colorado to her and said, hey, we'll let you in now. She in email said she was really, really glad I'd attacked her because that allowed her to get in the graduate program she'd always wanted to be in. Colorado's graduate program in philosophy is one of the top 40 in the country. Marquette's is barely in the top 100.
That's fascinating.
What does it say about the state of the landscape on college campuses that something like this, a student is shut down by the professor, he goes to another professor, he says this is what happened, you blog about it, say this isn't really consistent with free marketplace of ideas a college campus is supposed to be, or words to that effect, and it becomes this almost federal case. Literally, you got to take it to the Wisconsin State Supreme Court to make Marquette honor the terms of your employment contract. What does it just say about college campus? And then she's, she had to flee because somebody disagreed with her. It's just nonsense.
Well, to be blunt, it says the authoritarians tend to dominate college campuses. By the way, it's not just what she said to the student. When the student complained to the philosophy department chair, basically he was told he needed to change his attitude and be more respectful.
Yeah.
And then the philosophy department chair wrote to Cheryl Abbate, in effect saying, hey, you did okay. Well, I'm just paraphrasing. What she literally said is, let me know if the student gives you any more trouble. In other words, nobody in Marquette's the student then went to the Arts and Science office. Nobody in the Marquette administration seemed to care about the undergraduate. So when Marquette talks very piously about, we care for students, we care for the whole person, blah, blah, they didn't seem to care about this undergraduate.
Wow. So what kind of message do you think that this sends to other college campuses, say, Berkeley?
Well, I think it sends to any academic who's under fire for simply engaging in free speech, you can win, but you have to fight. There have been multiple cases of academics who were under fire, like one guy at the Duke Divinity School
who
sent
him
an email questioning diversity training. who come under fire and just walk away. You have to fight. And there are public interest law firms that will help you. In Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty helped me. They represented me pro bono. They're the best lawyers in Milwaukee. They're a self-selected bunch of freedom fighters. And, so they're people who will help you, but you've got to fight.
No, amen to that. Are you going to go back and teach poli-sci at Marquette?
Yes.
So you're...
Most certainly.
Sometimes
people ask, why would you want to go back there? The answer is the administrators are pretty terrible, but the students are pretty good. if you look at the students, it's not a hotbed of political correctness. Oh, there are social justice warriors on campus, and they're as intolerant at Marquette as there are anywhere, but that's not the majority of students. That's really only a small minority of students.
Maybe we need tolerance training for administrators and much of the professorate, it'd be a very short class. It's just defining the word tolerance. You only tolerate things you disagree with. There's nothing to tolerating opinions with which you agree. So if you're going to be tolerant, that necessarily means you're going to have to endure dissent. How about that?
Yeah. Well, tolerance is like, diversity. It seems to apply to some people, but not to others. Mm. It's only applied selectively when it serves a particular agenda.
He is John McAdams. He's a poli sci professor at Marquette University, and he is, again, thanks to Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision last week and thanks to his willingness to fight, and as he mentioned, some freedom fighters in Wisconsin, the legal community, taking up his case. Professor McAdams, congratulations. Thanks for joining us, and good luck at class.
Well, thank you very much.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The answer.
You want more than just the headlines? Find out what's going on and what it means with me, Dennis Prager, this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and we debate Permit Patty. Now, this is a case that's a couple weeks old, but it's a series of cases that... are not new, because we've talked about cases like this for years. The case where, you know, somebody shuts down a 10-year-old's lemonade stand because they don't have some stupid permit from the local unit of government, right? Yeah. Well, there's three cases that happened in just the course of a couple weeks over the last several that all went viral because there's video attached. One is this marijuana corp executive who called the police on an 8-year-old girl for the crime of illegally selling water without a permit. There's the neighbor who called police on a 12-year-old for his summer lawn mowing business, and a 16-year-old boy who was cuffed and arrested in Charleston, South Carolina.
For what?
Arrested for selling palmetto roses. You know, wow. Again, without a license. Thankfully, the police didn't act in the first two complaints.
Shoot him.
Arrested for selling palmetto roses in Charleston, South Carolina, 16-year-old. And, of course, this speaks to not the administrative state, because Steve Moore says I can't use that term, the regulatory state. But it also speaks to a cultural problem. And Gibran Khan has a good piece in National Review about this, that overregulation, oh, it's easy to blame the police, the bureaucrats, who concoct these Rube Goldberg regulatory schemes. But what about we who use those regulatory schemes to attempt to impose punishment on others, particularly kids? Idiotic. Here's the case of the Permit Patty case, if you will. That's what she was...
Yeah, her name's become known. Allison Edel.
Yeah, okay. So she's this executive. She, after this went viral because of the video, she went on to the Today Show to cry.
I tried to be polite, but I was stern. And I said, please, I'm trying to work. You're screaming, you're yelling, and people have open windows. It's a hot day. Can you please keep it down?
This is an 8-year-old girl selling water.
Right, without a permit, on the sidewalk, and she asked her another time, to move or to stop yelling so loud. Empathize with her. If you're trying to get some work done and this girl's like, he wants to buy water. And you're like, what are you doing? Why are you down there?
Here's what her mom said in response to Miss Permit Patty.
She never asked us to be quiet. She just came out and directly demanded to see a permit to sell water from an 8-year-old.
That's not what I was told. I watched the extensive, long, unedited version on CNN when they sat down with her.
Speaking of water, here come the waterworks.
All kinds of threats. Horrible. Horrible images. And death threats.
Threats of waterboarding, maybe. The mom of the 8-year-old, again, on the topic.
This woman don't want to let a little girl sell some water. She calling the police on an 8-year-old little girl. You can hide all you want. The whole world gonna see you, boo.
Yeah, and illegally selling water without a permit? Yeah.
On my property.
It's not your property.
Not her property.
Yeah.
It's not her property.
It was public property, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
the issue, though, of calling the police on an 8-year-old selling water, demanding to see a permit, on a 12-year-old for a summer lawn mowing business, on a 16-year-old... for selling palmetto roses. Seriously?
Well, we have to know that without rules, there's chaos. If they're doing it, then the bottom line,
okay,
for this permit Patty case, if that little girl was white, would we even be talking about this?
Yes, we would.
Do you think so?
Now, it's important you point that out because some people have suggested this race is involved here. All three of those cases I mentioned involve black children. However, we've talked about, there's a case in Southern Illinois we talked about last year, maybe it was 2 years ago. This little girl who had like selling cupcakes at a cupcake stand outside her home. She was white. And they came forward, the commissars from the municipality came forward. You have to have like an industrial oven, a commercial oven in order to sell cupcakes. I mean, honestly, the regulatory state. We should be encouraging entrepreneurship like this. Think about it. Think about how this translates to for the adults. Think about all that adults had to go through. And thanks again to the Illinois Policy Institute and others for food carts in Chicago, trucks in Chicago.
They didn't want them.
The idea of you have to have the rule of law. But just because something is the law doesn't mean the analysis is over. It means the analysis begins. Is this law just? Is it serving a purpose? Is it consistent with social mores? And
this little girl was trying to raise money. She said because her mom works two jobs and she was trying to help her. And also she wanted to go to Disney World. And guess what? She's got an all expense paid trip to Disney World with her and her family for 5 days.
So and Permit Patty doesn't get to go anywhere because she's unemployed now. She got fired.
Well, here's the thing, though.
Or asked
what
to
about
resign.
Redemption? I mean, her whole life is over because she
yes.
made one mistake.
Yeah.
One mistake, Dan, you're not going to give her a second chance.
Gulag goes Permit Patty. I don't know.
I mean, I don't think people are going to stop until she's dead.
Well.
No, true.
You know,
people are mean.
I don't know. Maybe if
she
they
made
get,
a mistake. I didn't like what she did, but I kind of understand why she did it because kids are annoying. And I know because I have a few. But then again, my kids are not out down the street selling things and trying to raise money like this little young entrepreneur is.
So I walked by the Walgreens in my neighborhood. Now I've got a phalanx of security, obviously,
because
I'm an important person. But I see there's kids that'll come up sometimes. They're selling like M&Ms, they say, for Little League or whatever.
Yeah,
so
sure, it's for Little League.
Jimmy wants
Just
to play
tell
Little
me.
League.
Yeah, okay.
Well,
yeah.
So hey, let me see your permit. Hey, Chicago police, get over here. I don't think this kid... I mean, honestly,
see, I, no,
who does
that?
Because
I get kids coming to my door all the time. We need uniforms for our school.
And you say, get out of here,
no,
you!
No, I say, well, what sport are you playing?
Uh-huh.
And then they'll say something that's completely off-season, like basketball when it's spring.
Right.
That's a winter sport. But what are you really selling this for?
And then...
Sometimes they'll get out a piece of paper and they'll say, well... It's for this, or they'll try and convince me. And sometimes I bite, and sometimes I just say, I give in other ways. But the people next door are very rich and very liberal. Why don't you try that?
And then how soon after those exchanges does your house get egged?
I haven't been egged yet. But
Teepeed?
No.
Arsoned?
Don't say that.
What?
Are
you worried about it?
Don't give anybody ideas.
No, this is the kind
I'm
of stuff.
Saying I don't want to be a sucker.
Is the kind of stuff, though, where I'm glad that Permit Patty is being made an example of. And I hope some of these other people who call the police on these kids. It's so much less about the police for me or about some code enforcement officer than it is about people who would enlist the state to go after this. I mean, there's the book, can't remember the lawyer's name now, Three Felonies a Day, talking about how unknowable the law is that the average American commits three felonies a day without even knowing it. Mm-hmm. Slivergate, I think, is his name. It's a really good book. And so this is sort of the same kind. The law is unknowable. It's enforced arbitrarily. You don't have the rule of law anymore. So it's very difficult to make a law and order argument here when the law is undermining the existence of the law. And that's what's actually happening. So I think...
Are we turning this into a Proft parenting tip?
I think, no, we're turning it into... Well,
I mean...
No, I'm glad the parents are encouraging, apparently encouraging these kids to be entrepreneurial. That's good. And now these dope... executives like Patty Kermit Patty. She's a dope. And I hope she never works again.
Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.